From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we start the hour with those severe storms pummeling the Midwest and the Plains. Overnight, tornadoes ripped through the Dayton, Ohio area. Several were injured. At least one person died about 60 miles northwest of the city. At least 40 homes have been destroyed, but that number will go up. In Indiana, two tornadoes were reported to have swept through the town of Pendleton, about 35 miles northeast of Indianapolis. And severe storms have dumped heavy rain in Arkansas and Oklahoma, both states dealing with major flooding. Rachel Hubbard of KOSU in Oklahoma City joins us. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Robin.
And there in Oklahoma, you also had tornadoes. Two people killed in El Reno by a tornado on Saturday, 29 injured, a lot of people homeless. A second tornado hit Tulsa on Sunday. So you had rain before and after that rain for weeks, homeless people. Describe the situation there.
Well, people here are just weary of the severe weather. We've had more than 100 tornado warnings over the last 30 days, dozens of flood warnings. People's phones are just constantly going off. And so we start to kind of worry that people are becoming sort of immune to the warnings because they're so constant.
Yeah, we understand the levee system in Tulsa is being pushed to its limit. The mayor there asking people to prepare for the worst. What does that mean?
Well, the Keystone Dam, the Keystone Lake is just above Tulsa to the west, and there are two flooded rivers that are converging on that dam. The lake there is 34 feet above normal. Tulsa, 335% of its normal rainfall. And so these levees, they're having to release what amounts to about 2 million gallons per second of water out of the dam at Keystone. That means that these levees that were built in the 1940s are really at their limit, and they have been for days. 1986 was Tulsa's flood of record, and those levees were under heavy pressure for 12 hours. This one more than a week, and they anticipate that the levees will be under this kind of pressure until at least Thursday, and that's if there's no additional rainfall.
So are people supposed to leave, or what are they supposed to do?
Well, the Army Corps of Engineers is trying to stay on top of the leaks in these levees, but there's still seepage. They're trying to keep it under control. Police have been driving through the neighborhoods, warning people that they should leave. They've opened two shelters for people who are willing to evacuate voluntarily. Tulsa is a flood model. They've worked really hard to keep this infrastructure in place, but officials tell residents in these areas that they'll have very little time if the levee does actually breach.
Well, they only have to look, we understand, to Moffett, Oklahoma. There's about 120 people who live in that town, but it was submerged by Saturday afternoon. Is that the Arkansas River?
Yeah, that's along the Arkansas River, and that community is not alone. As you move downstream from Tulsa, the Arkansas and the Verdigris Rivers start to converge, and we have towns like Braggs. Braggs is totally an island. You can only access it by helicopter or boat at this point. They're totally shut off, and there are about 200 people that are stranded there. Weber's Falls, completely underwater. They're having to shower at a fire department some miles away, and this is continuing on into small towns in Arkansas.
Yeah, I was going to say people in Arkansas watching across the river, and that Arkansas River expected to crest tomorrow, an historic 20 feet above flood stage. So just tough times there. Just a quick question. How are farmers coping with this rain?
Well, many farmers, especially in the river bottom areas, have totally lost their crops, especially in the area around Muskogee. So there will be disaster assistance following this, but many people are concerned because they may not have crop insurance. We're receiving some reports that they were advised getting it, getting some sort of flood insurance. So we're checking into that.
Yeah. Rachel Hubbard of KOSU in Oklahoma City, where more rain is expected. Rivers are cresting. Towns already submerged. We wish you all the best there, Rachel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, today the Supreme Court issued a split ruling on an Indiana abortion statute signed into law by Vice President Mike Pence when he was governor in the state. The law makes it illegal for abortion providers to dispose of fetal remains with other surgical tissue and instead mandates that fetal remains be separately buried or cremated. Although a lower court had struck down that provision, the Supreme Court today, by a 7-2 vote, upheld it. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg joins us now from Washington with more on this. Hi, Nina.
Hi.
So there's another part of this law that the court agreed should not stand, and we're going to get to that in a moment. But first, why did the court overrule the lower court on this part of the law?
Well, the court said that it didn't meet the standard, the law had a rational purpose. The purpose was that states want to regulate fetal remains and that they did so for a rational reason, and that therefore the court was not going to disturb the law and that the law should stand. Two justices dissented and said they would have struck it down, Justices Ginsburg and Sotomayor. Ginsburg styled hers as a concurrence because this was a per curiam unsigned opinion for the court. They treated this relatively briefly and said even that a fetal remains law might be challenged using a different, more rigorous standard. That is, that it imposed an undue burden on a woman's right to choose whether to have an abortion. Instead, they used the lower standard, said, look, the state has the right to regulate and had a decent reason here. If you could show that it imposes an undue burden, in some other case, have at it.
But meanwhile, there's this other provision of the law where the Supreme Court actually agreed with the lower court that it should be blocked. Tell us more about that part.
Well, the law bars abortion based on any diagnosis of fetal abnormality or disability or for reasons of race, sex, gender, ancestry, national origin, etc. Mm-hmm. And the lower court struck that down and said those choices essentially are up to a woman, not to that the law interferes with those choices. And the Supreme Court did not disturb that lower court ruling. That doesn't mean it upheld it. I know that sounds crazy, mm-hmm. but it didn't disturb it. It said, look, this is the first time we've gotten a case like this. So far, we don't see any reason to disturb it. We need to hear from other courts, and at some point later, we might disturb it. But we for the moment, uphold for all practical purposes what the lower court did, which was to strike down the law.
So does this give you any sense, as we've got all of these abortion laws coming up around the country that will eventually make their way to the Supreme Court, does today's ruling give you any sense of where the court is on this issue?
It looks like the court is where we all think it is, with five justices who never would have signed under Roe versus Wade. But some of them are unsure as to whether to reverse it outright, how far to go in undoing what the court has done since 1973 in assuring women a right to have an abortion in the first two trimesters, essentially, before the fetus is viable. And they're just not sure, I think, where they want to go and how far they want to go and how fast they want to go. But there's no doubt that you can see it even in the fetal remains part of this decision, that that's the direction in which they're going. But as I said, it's not clear how far they're going to go or how long it's mm-hmm. going to take.
But it does sound like Justice Clarence Thomas, one of the conservatives on the court, was critical today of the court's reluctance to take up the Indiana law more fully.
Critical is an understatement. Mm-hmm. He issued a 20-page opinion styled as a concurrence and blasting his colleagues, saying this case highlights the fact that abortion is an act rife with the potential for eugenic manipulation from the beginning. Birth control and abortion were promoted as means of effecting eugenics. And although he didn't go as far as to compare modern abortion and birth control to be mm-hmm. the product of elites seeking modern-day eugenics, he went on at great length about how the founders of Planned Parenthood a century ago or so did, and even more recently, he maintained. The court's decision, he says, to allow further percolation of this issue, the issue of whether you can terminate a pregnancy based on disability or race or sex, et cetera, should not be interpreted as an agreement with the decision below, enshrining a constitutional right of an unborn child as Planned Parenthood advocates would constitutionalize the views of the 20th century eugenics movement. So he had quite a day of saved up anger about abortion rights.
Nina, just a few seconds left here, but I just want to note that the court also left in place today a lower court ruling in favor of transgender students in a Pennsylvania school district.
This school district allows some transgender students to use whatever bathrooms they want. And the court let that stand. When a court, when the Supreme Court doesn't take up a case and just leaves it, that's what it does with thousands of cases that come to the court. It has no real significance except that the justices decided that they didn't want to hear this case or this issue now. And that's about all you can take away from it.
NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's for the whole song. Just pretend that to learn along. I've been there in 6 years. That's what I dream of when pen is burst.
That is the funk sound of Christine and the Queens, a breakout artist from France who doesn't shy away from proclaiming her oddity. She sings, she dances, and puts on an electric theatrical show. This is the song Come See, which kicks off her latest album, Chris. Well, the French native is taking her G-funk electronic pop music to audiences across the globe. She'll be touring all summer, and she joins me now from her tour. Welcome to Here and Now, and I guess I should first ask you, what should I call you? Should I call you Christine, or should I call you your real name, Héloïse Letissier?
You can even call me Chris, because it's shorter for Christine. And it's, yeah, it's my moniker. I can, it kind of makes me feel good. So you can call me Chris if you want.
Why is that? Who is Chris?
You know, Chris is me. It's just like putting a name on the weird process of being on the stage, because the stage is not especially the reality, but it's a way to express yourself that feels kind of like free of every label and every fear. So I guess Chris is just like the name I'm putting on my most audacious, daring version of myself.
Did you feel that you couldn't be that most audacious, daring version of yourself before?
Yes, I think when I decided to perform on a stage and sing, it shifted my whole life. I was a theater kid before. I studied stage design and I wanted to be a stage director. But I think the great shift was when I decided to be myself on the stage and own everything I could be on the stage. So I think, yes, I think before I was a bit shy and a bit self-conscious and I was fearing a lot of things, and now it's getting better.
One of the songs that a lot of people that have heard your music would know is the song Tilted. It was actually named one of the best songs of 2015 by Time Magazine. I just saw you perform it at Coachella in California recently. And you described, before you performed it, you described its message of one of queer identity. Tell me more about what that song means to you and what you were trying to say with it.
I think the song Tilted is interesting because you can enter through it many ways. If you want to enter in like a playful way, you can. And if you want to take Tilted as something way deeper and way more aching, you can also. And I think Tilted is, it means out of balance, slightly out of the norm and like out of it, because you are made to feel out of it because of like really narrow ways of existing. And I think being queer for me is questioning the norm, always. Actually, when you do pop music, it's so, there is so much theatricality that it can become really playful to question the norm. And it's actually important not to be digested by the same system that made you feel once an outcast. But I think being queer for me just helped me embrace the differences I could have and the awkwardness and what was made to feel like as flaws, you know. There is a way to embrace yourself way more, I think.
Well, and you describe yourself as pansexual, right?
Yep. I mean, it's just who I am. I don't have love stories depending on the gender of the person facing me. I kind of, I had different experiences with different ways of defining yourself. I even had like partners who didn't want to define themselves. It doesn't make any sense to me to just put a gender on someone. So I don't think like that.
You have to, or you have decided to record your songs, many of them, in both English and French. What is the challenge of that for you? How difficult is it to take a song that I assume was first written in French and then turn it into an English song with English lyrics?
Well, it's fun because it really depends on the record, actually. I remember, like, on my very first album called Chaleur Humaine, Human Warmth, some songs were written first in English, actually, and then I translated them in French. And on that second record, Chris, it's true that because I was working on, like, more up-tempo, funky energies, I was really interested in working the French before because it was more a challenge to make French sound good on a G-funk track, for example. And then I went back to English.
Qu'est-ce qu'une femme doit faire ici? Pas la folie assez, pas la folie assez. Qu'est-ce qu'une femme doit faire ici?
I think it's a good crash test for a song if I decide to translate it, because if I really know what I'm talking about and what I want to convey, it's actually not that hard because I just find a different way to address it. I think the different languages just bring a different angle to the track, which is quite delicious actually to work on. And if I don't really know how to translate the track, then it's probably a sign that I don't really know what I'm talking about. I don't know if I will do it every time like that because it's really like a two-headed record, this one. And also, like, it makes me work on like the musicality of language. So I can bring, for example, some English sounding atmosphere to French and vice versa, you see.
Well, you say in one track, I'm doing my face with magic marker.
I'm doing my face with a magic marker.
What's the French version of that one?
Well, actually, that was a challenge, this one, because in French, it's slightly different. In French, it's like literally, it's like I'm doing my makeup with Neosporin. Because in French, we do have like this... this thing to make the wounds heal better, but it's kind of like it leaves a mark on the skin, like a reddish mark. So, and I was trying to find like a cool equivalent in English, and so I found that.
Now, you've talked about some of your musical influences being Kendrick Lamar, David Bowie, Kanye West. And I've noticed in almost every one of the articles that have been written about this, Michael Jackson. First of all, how do you feel about that now? Or do you still like Michael Jackson as much as before, given all that's been in the news about him recently?
Well, you know, this is the huge, huge conversation about can we still love an artist if we know the man, or like if we have access to like dangerous morals of one person, can we still love the artist? The answer is probably yes. This is why it's kind of breaking the hearts of everybody, because we can't deny the impact of Michael Jackson on today's pop culture. But I mean, especially with Me Too and everything that, you know, is pouring out now, we always have to decide if we still can admire an artist or not. And also, that's a really personal question. I don't really think there is one way to answer it. But I think Michael Jackson comes in comparison because I love to use also the dancing and the singing. And I think he was one of the most impressive performers for that. And as a dancer, I don't know many dancers who just don't like Michael Jackson for that. And I think it's why it's always been sometimes plastered on me, because I'm like singing and dancing, so people are like, Michael Jackson. But it's true that I'm inspired also by, you named David Bowie, and like with every record came something different in terms of sound, of character, of thematics. But in the end, it makes a really cohesive work of art, and I think it's fantastic. I don't know many artists who could like explore like that and still be really always recognizable.
You know, you mentioned dancing. You're an incredible dancer. And I thought to myself as I was watching you both sing and dance at the same time, it must be, and I guess this is probably an issue for anybody who has to do what you're doing, but to be able to dance in that way and sing at the same time, it's got to be really difficult.
It is difficult. It's actually a constant work in progress, and you're always, like, in between the moments I tour, if I don't do, like, cardio and things like that, I immediately lose what I gained touring. I mean, it's something I always wanted to work on and achieve, and I hate the idea of doing playback, so even if sometimes I'm really out of breath, I keep on going. Mm-hmm. Because I kind of want people to see something real happening on stage. I always think of what I want to see as a music lover also, and I just want to see someone trying on stage very hard.
You know, you've been able to tour all over the United States. You're still on tour. What has stood out to you as you've sort of gotten to see parts of the U.S., not just the U.S., but the world as a touring musician?
Well, you know, I'm French, so I'm touring France, and then I toured the U.K., and then I toured the U.S., and then I went to Mexico. And every time there is a different way for my music to be perceived and received. And I think it's really actually kind of fascinating as a performer because, for example, my show is quite theatrical and sometimes bordering on contemporary dance. And I taught it in France and people were really like still and silent as if they were like watching a theater show because they were not used to it. And then I taught the US and they were really more engaged and loud and welcoming and warm. And then I taught the UK and it was just like full on dancing. So it was interesting to actually explore.
Do you think that Americans now get your music more than French people?
I think the Americans get the second record a bit more in the way that it's an exploration of sensuality and empowerment. I think that the empowering dimension of the second record in France was a bit missed. And I grew up with like really hybrid tastes, like we talked about Kanye West, but I could listen to French songs also. So I think my hybridity makes me sometimes more understood elsewhere. But I think, yeah, I think in America, people got the exciting vibe of the second record, like a celebration of life and desire.
So when's the next album coming?
Well, I'm working on new tracks right now. I don't know if I'm going to release a classic album, but I might have something ready for next fall. Maybe a smaller format, maybe an EP, something like that.
That is Chris of Christine and the Queens. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. Thank you for the nice chat.
Is it precisely
Here and Now and the following message is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single-serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and anytime in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box at dailyharvest.com/now.
On Bullseye, I talk with people who make amazing work. Greta Gerwig, Errol Morris, A$AP Ferg. The conversations are real and funny, and they take you somewhere unexpected. Find Bullseye with Jesse Thorne on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Trump administration's decision to ban American companies from doing business with Chinese telecom giant Huawei would seem to have little direct relation to rural Americans. But then we started hearing from rural cell phone providers this week saying they rely almost entirely on Huawei to deliver cell phone service to farmers and others in sparsely populated areas. Let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Robin.
So we already knew that Huawei is the second largest cell phone maker in the world and that the Trump administration feels it's an extension of the Chinese government. Equipment could be used for spying. It's also a pawn in the trade talks, so we have the ban. Tell us more about this technology that we're talking about for rural America.
So this is has put a light on something that we haven't talked about a lot, and that is that rural carriers don't make as much money as urban carriers, right? There's more infrastructure for fewer people. So in rural areas of America, there's often not as good internet service as there are in urban areas, and those companies tend to go for the least expensive equipment, and that's what Huawei does. Huawei manufactures the equipment that you need to provide wireless and internet service, and in many of these cases, these underfunded, smaller rural companies use Huawei equipment. Mm-hmm. And the ban on that would mean literally that they are going to be without internet. There are going to be a lot of places without internet. And that is the fact that a lot of rural Americans are facing right now.
Or internet expansion. We're reading about a farmer with a broken part. He's out in the field and he's being told by a repair shop that's 65 miles away, send us a picture. He can't. There's no reception. And the small American company that was going to expand the reception there with equipment from Huawei now isn't.
Correct. And so this is going to be, depending on who you ask, up to a $1 billion problem, right? Because these companies now have to buy equipment. There are not a lot of American makers, believe it or not, of this equipment. There are European providers, but we're talking about up to $1 billion. And there are a lot of people wondering today, when's this going to come? What's going to happen? Remember, it's not just regular folks using their stuff. Farmers depend on the internet for their business. Lots of businesses have gone out to these places because there was internet service, and now they may lose that.
Well, a bipartisan group of senators has proposed a bill that would offer $700 million to these rural providers to offset the cost of ripping out their Huawei technology, installing some alternative. Is that a solution, and is there an alternative? You say not many American companies.
So the concept is good. This bipartisan group of senators, many from rural states with large rural populations, they get the problem. But every expert we've spoken to says $700 million is not enough. Now, it's not that far off from the estimates. The estimates from the Rural Wireless Association is between $800 million and $1 billion. So they're saying, wait, don't do this unless you're putting the right amount of money in, because you'll think you've solved the problem and lots of Americans are suddenly going to be without wireless access or internet access because you didn't fund it high enough. So that's where the discussion is right now. Bill's good, but can you up the money?
Right. Meanwhile, in 2017, we should know, China did pass a law which would compel corporations to assist in offensive intelligence gathering operations. So there is reason for some concern about putting them, you know, inside internet
there
operations in the
Red
Rocks. Yeah. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. We'd love to hear from farmers who have thoughts on this, people in rural areas who have thoughts on it at hearnow.org. Meanwhile, Ali, thanks so much.
Very good. Thank you.
In Florida, starting this fall, teachers will be eligible to carry guns in schools. Governor Ron DeSantis signed the change into law earlier this month. He says it'll make Florida schools safer, which has been a goal in the state more than a year after the massacre at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland. We want to look at two different perspectives on this change, starting with Bill Husfeldt, superintendent of Bay District Schools in Bay County, Florida, in the Panhandle. He joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity, Jeremy.
And you are a supporter of this bill. Is your district going to arm teachers?
Well, yes, I'm support of it. I believe that with everything that we learned from Parkland and the timing and need to protect our students, we don't have a lot of choices. We just don't have many options. The required 142 hours of training for individuals, not just teachers, that want to go through this is very extensive. The background checks, psychological background checks as well, help us to weed out. We don't just give guns to anybody that wants one. I mean, there's a very extensive process that we work with the Sheriff's Department. We implemented this last year. Mm-hmm. And so we did not have teachers per se, but we had coaches and ROTC instructors and administrators were eligible for it. And this year, the law expands that to teachers.
Teachers that want to be armed.
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, we're not going to have, I don't want to get into numbers because you obviously don't want to tell people how many you have, but there's not going to be a large number of teachers with guns in any one school. I believe that again, what we learned from Parkland was that there were someone like that wants to do harm is going to do it in a 3 to 4 minute time span. And even if you have an armed law enforcement officer in every school, which we do in every school, even elementary schools, the response time just leaves a crazed shooter enough time to do terrible things. And so one of the things that we believe is a very viable option is to train individuals that are willing to protect our children to do so. And Jeremy, if you don't mind, I'll just say this, that there's no doubt in my mind that most of our teachers would stand in front of a crazed gunman and take a bullet for mm-hmm. our students. But I just feel like that we have got to trust some of these teachers that would do that to protect our students as well and give them a fighting chance. God forbid we have a situation like that.
Now, many teachers are against this, including the American Federation of Teachers. That's the teachers' union. Have mm-hmm. you heard from teachers who don't want to carry guns?
Oh, yes. I mean, we have a great relationship with our teachers union here. The president of the union is not for this. Her and I have had great conversations about it. And ironically, she's a former Marine. But she just does not believe it needs to be done. And I respect her, and she respects our choice. The challenge, Jeremy, is for people to understand what happened at Parkland, to delve into the situation, how that all played out, and what was done step by step, and what you can do to protect your children. Ironically, right now, one of the things we're training all of our employees and starting now is Stop the Bleed. We're working on that. So we're going to train our teachers to be doctors and nurses. God forbid a student gets shot, but we don't want to give them any way to protect themselves from getting shot. And so this is just part of that process. And I know not everyone agrees with it. I completely understand that. And I'm not one of those that's got a bumper sticker on my truck that says insured by Smith & Wesson. I'm not a crazed gun person, but I do know that specifically what happened at Parkland can happen anywhere. And the response time of law enforcement to get there to protect our children and our teachers just is extremely limited.
There are concerns also that this could lead to more violence and that minority students in particular could be maybe wrongfully shot by a teacher, maybe in a misunderstanding. Some have called for teachers to go through racial bias training. How are you going to protect minority students in case of something like that?
Jeremy, that's part of the training. The racial bias is part of the required training, just exactly for that reason. And I will tell you this, we have a large segment of our population is minority, different ethnic groups, and a large segment of our teacher population is minority. And so we do understand the complications in that, and we all try to improve our individual outlook on that and the process whereby each person is equal in understanding that. Again, we're just not giving a gun to a teacher that we have any doubts or worries about that might not be thinking fully. We are going through an extensive process to vet these people and then to train them. And so I think the likelihood, you know, you want to think that a gunman can never come into a school and do anything like that. That's not going to happen. Jeremy, the board members and myself were held hostage by a gunman here 9 years ago at our school board office. And until you've been in a situation like that where you're held hostage with someone's got a gun and they start shooting at you and you have no way to protect or defend yourself, I think it's very hard to understand the deep down issues of why we believe this is so important. And again, I respect everybody's different view on this. I know everyone feels differently, but I think people need to look and see what happened at Parkland in understanding that those victims had no level of protection at all from an assailant that decided to come in there and murder children.
Mm-hmm. I still do, though, want to ask you about some of the unintended consequences that people wonder about with a law like this. And one of them is that there could be a child getting a hold of one of these weapons. How do you protect against that sort of thing?
Well, and I think that happens even with police officers in their homes and mom and dads that have guns in their homes. I think that is always a tragic possibility. I would believe that would be less of a possibility than right now an armed gunman coming into a school campus. I still believe schools are the safest place to be, but I'm not totally blind to the fact that accidents can't happen anywhere. But that's part of the training also, is the maintenance of those weapons and how to deal with it and how to take care of it. So I believe that we're trying to answer what you're talking about, the accidents, the bad decisions. I've been to the training and watched those trainings. They go through very rigorous trainings like police officers do. I even saw them on the range practicing where they had to come around the corner and there was a gunman holding a hostage in front of them where the person being trained had to decide whether to shoot or not shoot. So, I mean, those kind of things are discussed and they're part of the training. They're part of the whole process. And, you know, we hope we never get to it. I mean, no one ever wants to deal with something like this. But in the real world we live in now, there's a school shooting almost every week somewhere.
Do you know how much it's going to cost to arm the teachers that want to be armed, get the training that's required, and obviously the cost of the guns themselves?
I know that the state put in a hefty amount. It was, I think, approximately $70 million last year to implement it, and I don't think they spent but maybe $30 to $40 million on it. So there's a lot of money put into it, but it still wouldn't cover the cost of adding more officers in schools. As I said, we have 43 schools in our district, and every school has a law enforcement officer. I'm not talking about a security guard. I'm talking about law enforcement officer. They're either on our police force or they're a Bay County Sheriff's deputy. And so they're on every school campus. What we're looking for is what Parkland didn't have was a backup or mm-hmm. someone to also be there. When you get on some of these campuses, they're two or three city blocks big, some of these campuses are. And there's just no way that you can fully cover the size of these campuses in the time something tragic could happen.
That's Bill Husfeldt, who's superintendent of Bay District Schools in Bay County, Florida. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I wish you the best, Jeremy.
And tomorrow we'll hear from a Parkland teacher who does not want teachers to be armed in the classroom.
I am a gun owner, but I have not had the training nor the experience. I don't want that responsibility.
That is tomorrow on Here and Now, and we welcome your thoughts on this issue at hereandnow.org.
Quick note, France's finance minister says a merger between the French company Renault and the Italian-American company Fiat Chrysler would be a good opportunity for both Renault and the European auto industry, but warned that local jobs would need to be protected. Italy is also concerned about a loss of jobs, but if the merger does go through, the two companies combined would become the world's third largest automaker, behind Japan's Toyota and Germany's Volkswagen. Well, staying with cars, let's look at Tesla and the man who's been called the Dr. Frankenstein of Tesla. Rich Benoit of Salem, Massachusetts, has a hobby of salvaging and restoring electric cars. Now he's taking his weekend car projects to the next level, planning to open a Tesla repair shop. But as WBUR's Quincy Walders reports, he might face some pushback from the automaker.
There we go.
Rich Benoit and some of his car enthusiast friends are taking a blowtorch to Tesla battery cells they put inside a toaster oven. They're testing a heat paste, seeing if it works better than the battery coolant Tesla uses. It's fun and all, but Benoit says they're trying to tackle a serious problem.
As of late, there's been a lot of unfortunate Tesla fires, where whether that's be by accidental reasons, manufacturing defects. What we're testing now is we're testing to see what other things we can do to actually reduce the likelihood of fires.
Look how much. One, two, three, four, five, 6 seconds. Usually it takes about a second and a half or so.
The one holding the blowtorch is Benoit's friend Lee Malo. He owns a European car shop in Gloucester, Massachusetts, where he and Benoit do these types of experiments. Malo found Benoit online.
And now we're, I would say, a community of Rich's friends, all because of him getting into Tesla and doing a YouTube page.
A YouTube page called Rich Rebuilds, where Benoit chronicles his journey of starting off with irreparable electric vehicles and making them work again. He also rants about how Tesla is reluctant to help obtain parts if a car was totaled and taken off of a service list.
You don't have Tesla support in rebuilding these cars. Basic repair is almost impossible without using their software. Tesla's also not going to sell you parts if your car is salvaged either. You know, Elon Musk is out here using rockets and I can't get basic diagnostic functionality?
Benoit says this frustrating process is why his DIY experimentation days are taking a backseat to a more legit endeavor. He wants others to be able to bypass those barriers too. So Benoit has opened a shop called Electrified Garage with a few Tesla employees in New Hampshire. He believes his boutique shop will be able to repair cars faster than Tesla and cheaper too. And he might be on to something. CEO Elon Musk acknowledged that Tesla has been lacking in its servicing of vehicles in a conference call with investors in January.
I think we made a strategic error in the past about not having service parts located at our service centers, which basically meant it was impossible to have a fast turnaround on servicing a car. Even for a very simple repair, it could take days.
You could wait months before your car is fixed. And I said to myself, you know what? I'm good at this. I know how to do this. You know, I have a team of guys. I know how to do this too.
This is all happening without Tesla's explicit blessing. Tesla says while there are third-party repair shops, it restricts the sale of certain parts because of potential dangers when mixing designs and software. But that doesn't really mean anything to Benoit. He says the purpose of his shop is to fill the void Tesla hasn't.
Why can't we disrupt their market? Now we're coming in and saying, the small guy could do this just as well as you can. Here's an alternative.
So far, Benoit's worked on more than 10 Teslas. He's salvaged from wrecks, like taking usable parts from the good half of a car in a rear-end collision and parts from the good half of a car in a front-end collision to make a whole working car.
Over the years, over purchasing so many vehicles, you know, I have quite the part collection. So
where is it?
It's actually right behind that door right there.
Oh, okay.
So there's really no need for me to call Tesla probably ever again.
Could I see you?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a little messy, but...
We walk into a dimly lit room Benoit calls the lair. There's a tri-tiered floor-to-ceiling shrine of Tesla parts, AC compressors, batteries, display screens, nearly all the parts that make up a Tesla Model S. We hop into his Model S, his first restoration. He calls it Dolores.
So is the car on already?
Yeah, the car's actually on right now.
He says he'll never get used to how quiet the car is, so quiet he can sneak up on deer.
The only sound you hear is just nothingness.
So there's no...
No. No, it's a weird experience, isn't it? It's kind of like a weird, like... This is where the future's going. It's just... silence.
Benoit says opening his repair shop isn't about taking on Tesla. It's about letting people get that mystifying feeling he gets when he turns on the engine. Ultimately, Benoit says his dream is to have his own electric car company, one where people would be encouraged to repair and modify their own vehicles. But that's for someday, in his vision of that silent future. For Here and Now, I'm Quincy Walters.
Great story. But why would you want to sneak up on deer in your car? Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.